continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
The new Democratic dilemma: is the current leadership bold enough, or is it time to dump Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer? And Bankruptcy 101, our series, the financial and emotional toll filing bankruptcy can take on you. Good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I am Verna Avery Brown. When Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and nine fellow Senate Democrats delivered Republicans the needed votes to pass what is inarguably the most draconian bill in decades, many Democrats felt like they had been sucker punched by their own party. Approval ratings for the Democratic Party plummeted, with only 27% feeling favorable about the leadership. There's serious talk underway about replacing Schumer for a more aggressive leader to fight the president at a time when many feel the country is slipping into fascism on a daily basis. Adam Green is the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which has been advising Democrats on messaging for the fight against Donald Trump and Elon Musk. Previously, Adam worked in communication roles with the Democratic National Committee, MoveOn.org, the New Jersey Democratic Party, and in South Dakota for the top-winning U.S. Senate race of 2002. He has a BA from George Washington University and a law degree from the University of Virginia. He has appeared on ABC, NBC, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, and C-SPAN. And good morning, Adam Green, and thank you for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, and thank you for that very thorough bio. Appreciate it. My mom will be proud.
Well, we want to keep mom happy. Okay. So Adam, Senator Schumer has, he was on MSNBC with Chris Hayes last night, and he basically dug in on his reasoning for handing the Republicans and Trump the victory to implement one of the most draconian pieces of legislation to ever pass the Congress in recent years. Schumer's reasoning was that to vote against it allowed a government shutdown that would have given Trump and his co-president Musk absolute power to determine what are essential services and what are not. Trump, he says, would have had the authority to completely cut Medicaid if he chose to, and other services, creating a situation far worse than what the bill would actually allow. And moreover, said Schumer, there's no exit ramp. How do you close it down? He asked. So, Adam, how bad is the continuing resolution that got passed? And do you give any credence to Senator Schumer's position that things could have gotten considerably worse if Trump had the executive power under the shutdown?
The continuing resolution is bad. I do give some credence to what Schumer is saying. But I would actually start off with a little, you mentioned GW. I would start off with a story. You know, back when I did some protests on the campus of GW, our university president gave me a cartoon of one person at a bar kind of drunk and slumped over the bar, and a sober person looking at this drunk person saying, "Yes, I know, you're completely misunderstood," right? And I kind of feel like at this moment, where it's not just on Chris Hayes, but Jon Stewart is lampooning Chuck Schumer, the ladies of The View are saying, "We think you caved." All the groups who are in touch with the public and organizing the public, most of his fellow senators, are just saying, "You're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong." At some point, you gotta believe that you might be wrong. And here's what I would say. There were two very tough choices. I would grant that point. And, you know, we had direct conversations with the senator's office before the vote. And everyone agrees that this White House will fire lots of people, whether or not there is a shutdown, but their job would be made easier if there was a shutdown. Okay. The key question of how do we get out of a shutdown is the relevant one. And this is where you either believe or don't believe that you can engage in and win a fight. We were asked that question, the exact question that you said that Chuck Schumer was asking, you know, rhetorically, how do you land the plane? How do you get out of the shutdown? And we gave an answer, which is, it's not hypothetical. We already are seeing evidence that Republican House politicians are feeling pain when local Trump voters and veterans and moms and dads and grandparents back home are expressing their displeasure with what Trump is doing to their community. And what we should be doing if there's a shutdown is exacerbate that pain on Republican politicians so they come to the table and cut a deal.
Yeah, but the Republican politicians, they should be feeling the pain now. And all they've decided to do is hide out, not hold more town hall meetings.
That's exactly right. And, you know, one thing we've been working with Senate Democrats on is ensuring that where House Republicans are not doing town hall meetings, the Democratic senators from their states go into those red districts and hold town hall meetings. And some great news, there's actually four senators who have done that this week. Actually five. Michael Bennett in Colorado is going to Republican districts. Ruben Gallego in Arizona is going to Republican districts. Both Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden in Oregon are going to Republican districts. And just yesterday, Andy Kim in New Jersey announced that he would be going to three different Republican districts. And their basic point is, if you won't listen to your constituents, I will. Mm-hmm. So our thinking was, that's what we have to do to increase the pain on Republicans. But Chuck Schumer had a different view. And unfortunately, it sends a signal to many people across the country that Democrats are not willing to fight in this moment when we need the fighting more than ever.
You know what I would like to see? A bipartisan team going into these red states where they've decided not to hold these town hall meetings. Maybe you can get some Republican lawmakers that have retired or are not in office now, and they don't have that same concern with Donald Trump, perhaps. Maybe they do. We don't know. But if you could get a bipartisan team going into these red states, that might even be more effective. But I'm glad to see that some Democrats have decided to start going into these red states.
Okay. That point you just made might actually change the trajectory of my next couple of weeks. That is a brilliant point. I had been focused on trying to find Trump voters to speak out at these meetings, but I think you're absolutely right. It would be very powerful to find even retired elected officials. So thank you for that idea.
Yes. Well, just tribute me when you do. No, I'm just teasing. So in terms of leverage, Adam, that the Democrats had at that moment, Schumer said they had basically two choices: sign the bill or shut down. And he says attempts to force the GOP to adopt the Democratic alternative were basically futile. Quote, they weren't going to negotiate with us, end quote. What leverage do you believe the Democrats had against hardliner Republicans like that? I mean, we've seen how they do not waver. They vote in lockstep with Trump. Schumer said they wouldn't even sit down with us for nothing, end quote. So what leverage? Do you think the Democrats had some leverage at that point?
So we actually have seen that the Republicans will waver. They wavered by letting the word go out to please stop having town hall meetings because their members were squealing. They were feeling the pressure. They were calling the White House chief of staff to Capitol Hill to explain these DOGE cuts to things like veterans health care and kids nutrition and Medicaid and Medicare, Social Security. So their solution was stop the pain by not having town hall meetings. That's why we could have had leverage by increasing the pain and holding town hall meetings. Now, what's interesting is that Chuck Schumer is actually conceding that point. He has said in the New York Times and other places in the last 48 hours that his theory of the case, when he's asked, why won't this exact same thing happen over and over again, including at the next carbon copy funding bill fight in 6 months when the funding comes due, his answer was, you know, we need to get Trump's popularity down. And once the public hears all the bad stuff he's doing, and we advance that message and his popularity comes down, then Republicans will break away from him. Okay, so now we're just debating timing. now we're again back to my original question. Do you believe you can mobilize the public and win the fight? He's saying we can do it in 6 months. I'm saying we should have tried to do it in 2 weeks, or we could have tried to do it in 2 weeks. It's at least a credible idea. It's happened mm-hmm. many times in history. Like, this week is a congressional recess. This is the golden week for engaging people back home. All the stars were aligned. Indivisible is doing empty seat town halls in dozens and dozens of districts around this country. Democratic politicians are doing events, making the case in local media markets. This was the week to apply the pressure. Mm-hmm. And what's unfortunate is that we're even talking about Chuck Schumer right now. We should be having a full throttle discussion about how Republicans want to steal people's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans' health care, kids' nutrition benefits in order to line Elon Musk's pockets and give tax cuts to the very wealthy in a few months. Mm-hmm. And instead, we've been diverted because of what Chuck Schumer just did by caving. And we warned about this in advance. We said, please don't mess up this recess week. And unfortunately, it's driving too much of the news right now.
Mm-hmm. So the problem with that, you know, let's just wait until, you know, eventually Trump's, the public realizes what a terrible job Trump is doing. The problem with that is we don't have time for the entire government could be redesigned. It's not like we have time. They're taking advantage of the time. Yeah. Now, the takeaway from the interview with Schumer last night on MSNBC's Chris Hayes was that Schumer doesn't believe we are currently facing a constitutional crisis, and that could explain his strategy. Yeah. He referred to the court system and the 235 judges that the Biden administration put in place. But even though the Trump administration suffered a couple of legal blows in the courts as recently as yesterday, some Democrats and progressives don't hold much faith in that course of action. Ellie Mistal, a correspondent with Nation magazine, is among them.
Courts are going to save us. The institutions will hold. All of these lawsuits that we have filed against them will lead to some result or restraint against Trump. I would like to ask those people, especially the people in our own community, what do you got now? Because Trump is in violation of various court orders across a host of federal issues, and I don't see anybody stopping him. The judge says turn the planes around. Trump says no. Venezuelans are in El Salvador right now. The judge says do not deport the doctor from Brown who specializes in kidney transplants and had a valid work visa. Do not deport her. Trump says, oh, she's already gone. Judge says turn on the money and restore funding to USAID. Trump says no. Judge says turn on the money, restore the federal funding that you froze from all the universities and organizations that practice what they call DEI. Trump says no. So great. So that's where we are. You have your court order. You have your courts are coming to save us. You have your institutions have held. Trump's not following them. So what you got next? And this is the part. This is the problem. I think also from our side, we don't got anything next. We've spent entirely too much time relying on the courts, begging on the courts, hoping against hope that the courts will come to save us. Well, now the courts are actually doing the things that we want them to do to stop Trump, but Trump ain't stopped. Trump ain't stopping Jack. And so that to me is why that strategy was never going to work. Trump is just straight up ignoring court orders now, and nobody seems to have any theory even of change. Nobody seems to have any plan for what to do next.
Ellie Mistal, correspondent with The Nation, speaking on Roland Martin Unfiltered Live. So as I always say, who's going to check him, boo? So, you know, Trump is out there basically giving the middle finger to the courts. And if that happens, if he just continues to do that, are we in an autocracy? Has fascism arrived? Adam, what's your response to that?
Yeah, you're putting your finger, whichever finger it is, on a very important dynamic here, which is, you know, authoritarianism is here. Fascism is here. It's not coming. And, you know, Ellie works for a progressive magazine, The Nation. You know, our website is boldprogressives.org. But what's interesting is that this is not, the fissure in the Democratic Party right now is not progressives versus conservatives or moderates. It's, do you get it or do you not get it? that these are not normal times and this is an existential moment for America. We're maybe we're at the bottom yet, but we are in the downward spiral right now. And that is the crisis. The spiral is the crisis. It's not just getting to the bottom, worst case scenario. And Chuck Schumer, I guess he was being honest, he showed his hand that he doesn't get that fact. Mm-hmm. What's been interesting about this moment is, again, I mentioned before, the Democrats going to Republican districts include Michael Bennett of Colorado. Most of your listeners probably never heard of the guy. He's not a flamethrower. He's not seen as a big progressive or liberal. You know, Ruben Gallego goes back and forth between being progressive and seen as moderate. You know, Chris Murphy, who's had a real role the last several months, you know, cut his teeth doing foreign policy, is seen as a very serious person in Washington, really isn't seen as a grenade thrower, but he is taking the lead on a thought level, going on independent media, MSNBC, sounding the alarm bell saying, this is a crisis. We need to treat it like the crisis it is. And that's why he voted against Schumer this past week. So again, that's the dividing line right now. And I, you know, the one thing I would disagree with Ellie on is that there's not a plan. No plan is guaranteed to work. There's no silver bullet. I would agree with that. But it is encouraging to me that, you know, Bernie Sanders first and then AOC and Mark Buchanan in Wisconsin and now several of the Democratic Party committees, the DSCC, the Democratic Governors Association, folks like that, the DNC, are going on tour to Republican districts to give voice to what is happening in Washington. You know, I think eventually there will be more actions in the streets. So we really haven't seen that mass protest yet. But it makes sense that an intermediary step would be hitting the road, having tens of thousands of people in an auditorium or thousands in some, and just galvanizing the public. So that is a necessary ingredient to mobilizing the public, and I'm glad.
Okay, so let everybody gets riled up and they're in the streets and the public is galvanized, then what? What about going to these congressional offices and confronting these congressmen and women? And putting if they won't come to, what do they say, take the mountain to Muhammad? If Muhammad, you know, what about going in their face, up front in their face? Those are the type of tactics that probably need to be. What strategy would you like to see that if there were going to be a new Democratic leader? I doubt that there is, but if there were going to be a new Democratic leader, what strategy would you like for him or her to pursue?
Yeah, well, you know, my starting point is actually that, you know, leadership is in the eye of the beholder. And, you know, in the response to Trump's State of the Union, Chuck Schumer appointed Alyssa Slotkin to give a speech. I thought it was a fine speech. It wasn't an excellent speech, but it was a pretty good speech. AOC went on Instagram Live, you know, in a sweatshirt before she went to bed and got, you know, exponentially more views than Alyssa Slotkin got. So who's the leader in that situation? One was appointed by the leader to give a response. The other actually led. So I would actually kind of reframe things as, what can we all do to be leaders, right? And then, you know, who do we respect as thought leaders in that process? And that gets to your point about getting in people's faces. You know, that getting in a politician's face, particularly a Republican politician who is being cowardly and just going, you know, compliant with DOGE, or Democratic politicians to make sure that they stand with backbone more than they are now, is an act of leadership. And I can tell you, as somebody who runs an organization that deals with many politicians, aspiring elected leaders and actual elected leaders, you know, in normal times, if three donors say something to a politician as they're phone calling, asking for money, they're like, oh boy, everybody's talking about this. Three people, really, it really is a rule of three, right? Now, that's enough to stand out in an otherwise busy life. Now imagine someone's at the grocery store and they get confronted. Someone's walking into the congressional office, they get confronted. Someone has any kind of meeting and they get confronted. That stands out in their mind. Even if they walk past you and don't say anything, they are taking that in. That is data to them. And they are talking about it in the hallways, or to use Chuck Schumer's terminology, at the gym in Congress. Mm-hmm. They are telling their colleagues. So I think the question is, as there's this shock and awe strategy, flood the zone strategy coming from Trump, which is intentionally designed to demoralize us into inaction, what is one thing we can each do every day? Mm-hmm. And when we have the opportunities, when we accidentally see a politician walking by, and especially those of us in Washington, D.C.
Or you see J.D. Vance trying to ski or going to the Kennedy Center and getting booed.
Perfect examples. Exactly. Those people were leaders. They didn't have to boo. It's not polite to boo at the Kennedy Center, but they did it. A little bit more polite to boo on the side of the road in Vermont, but they did it too. Like, those are acts of leadership in my mind. I think all of us can challenge ourselves to do it, knowing that it actually does have an impact. And yeah. Chuck Schumer's theory of the world, you know, that is one small step to getting Trump to have lower popularity and Republicans to break.
Now, when you talk about being polite, Representative Al Green from Texas took bold action during the State of the Union address. The others just kind of sat there waving paddles. It's been reported that they wanted to maintain some sense of decorum. There is a time for decorum, but I'm not sure it's appropriate in the face of rising fascism.
Yes.
Your thoughts about that, Adam?
Absolutely. You are a very profound person. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Adam.
Yeah. You know, again, I think it comes down to those who get it and those who don't get it. And this idea of old school collegiality and decorum, normal rules, you know, they have to go out the door. So again, a Democratic senator proactively going to a Republican House member in their state district to hold a town hall is something that in yesteryear would have been seen as a breach of decorum, a breach of collegiality, stepping on toes. And therefore, it's encouraging that that's starting to happen. Again, just this week, five different senators, hopefully more to come. You know, the Al Green thing, I have some mixed thoughts on that. I agree that he was courageous. I don't think it was the most effective action, but I couldn't actually understand what he was saying on TV. But I'm told, and I heard even from Simone Sanders on MSNBC, that she was getting text messages from congressional members and staffers that they were told by House Democratic leadership not to do anything like that. That they were told, oh, just bring a constituent to sit next to you at the State of the Union who has a real person story, which is fine for, like, if the local paper back home wants to write a profile of that person, that's great. But that wastes a moment with tens of millions of eyeballs. And wouldn't it have been amazing if Al Green or someone else like Maxwell Frost were saying something that was understood and 30 of their colleagues walked out with them?
Yes.
Right? You know, when Donald Trump said, we can't have unelected bureaucrats running the government, when Elon Musk is sitting there on the balcony, maybe that would have been a moment for 40 members to walk out and point at Elon Musk and the bureaucrat, right? There could have been mass actions. And that's not like storming the stage. That's not violence. That's
right.
Illegal. That's just more effective and in your face. Mm. And it didn't happen, sadly.
I couldn't agree more. Okay, tell us, Adam, about the survey that Progressive Change Campaign is conducting.
Yeah, so the survey is still open. People can go to SchumerSurvey.com. And so far, over 20,000 people have answered the question we posed, which is, do you have confidence in Chuck Schumer remaining or as, you know, serving as Democratic Senate leader? And over 80% of people, both nationally and in New York, his home state, have said no so far. You know, we have not yet called on him to step down, but we are inserting this into the public dialogue as a very strong piece of guidance, both for him and other Democrats, about the reaction that the public has to a failure of leadership and the caving, the capitulation by Democrats to Trump in this extraordinary era. And so, our hope is that other Democrats get the hint and don't replicate his actions.
So the objective to actually get Senator Schumer to step down, I mean, there would be one less vote in the Senate, and it would be, a major distraction from the fight against Trump and Musk.
Yeah, it's funny. I just to choose the words a little more clearly, even Indivisible, which has called on him to step down, called on him to step down as Democratic leader, not leave the Senate.
Oh, so I see.
It wouldn't affect the vote count. But, what I said yesterday to an NBC reporter just kind of popped out. I was like, this is not a June debate moment for Chuck Schumer, but it is a falling off the bike moment, right? Mm-hmm. It's an indicator of some potential things to come. It's a warning to people that, something's up here. And, I think the dam has broken. Like, the topic of his leadership has been broached, and it's never been broached before in a serious way. Right? Not just Indivisible, Hakeem Jeffries, last Friday at a press conference, when asked should he remain Democratic leader, said next question.
But he finally eventually said he does support Schumer. And I'm wondering what the Senate caucus, Democratic caucus, is with regard to Schumer. Are they supporting him or not?
So it's funny. The next example I was going to give is Chris Murphy, senator, on Meet the Press this past weekend, was asked, do you think Chuck Schumer is the best person to be leader at this point? And he basically said, he can be leader. It is possible. It exists. And he was pressed multiple times, and that was his line. And I have heard, you know, privately from many senators grumbling about his leadership. So, like, the kindling is there. I don't think last week was the match to have the kindling explode into a wild bonfire. But the kindling is there and growing. And that's why I'm saying people are on watch now. His actions are under more scrutiny. That actually itself is a form of leverage for those of us who want the Democratic Party at large to have a backbone. I think, you know, he will be probably more encouraging this week than he would have been 2 weeks ago of organizing Democratic senators to go into Republican districts, because he has to do something to stem the bleeding and show that he's fighting. Right. So, and if he has, you know, royal mess ups, or if his theory of the case doesn't come true and Democrats cave again in 6 months, then I think we're having an entirely different conversation. But again, I would just say, you know, just the fact that he was elected leader doesn't mean he's the leader of the Democratic Party. I think others who are speaking out publicly, reaching millions, people like Bernie Sanders and others going on the road, reaching, you know, tens of thousands at a time, are leaders. And those of us in our daily lives who are taking one action per day to just, you know, make an impression upon politicians, either Republicans that they're off course or Democrats that they need more backbone, are exercising leadership. And that's where we need to focus in the short term.
So there's no one particular name that's being floated to sort of take the place of Schumer.
Well, you know, the name I've heard most is Chris Murphy, just because he's been so out front and showing that he gets it. Again, Chris Murphy from Connecticut, been in there, I think, since 2012. And, you know, just has, you know, he's taken to social media, he's taken to podcasts, he's taken to independent media, and he's welcome on the MSNBCs and CNNs of the world. Very good communicator. You know, I think if senators could wave a magic wand and have him in there as a replacement, they would do it in a second. I'm not sure who else. You know, Brian Schatz is someone who gets mentioned a lot and I like a lot as a leader. You know, he voted with Schumer, so that's probably not in the cards if it were going to happen right now. I'm not sure. Are there others that you've heard?
Not necessarily, no. Yeah. But, you know, I will say that Chuck Schumer has said he's not going anywhere. So on that note, Adam Green, co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which has been advising Democrats on messaging for the fight against Donald Trump and Elon Musk. Adam, thank you so very much for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you so much. And I invite your listeners to join us at boldprogressives.org. Get looped into our activism.
Okay. Well, now, so when you're granted a Chapter 7 bankruptcy and all or most of your debts are discharged, is relief the only emotion you will feel? When we come back, the final in our Bankruptcy 101 series, as we examine both the financial and emotional toll bankruptcy can take. Back in 60 seconds.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of March 17, 2025. On Wednesday, March 19th at 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., there will be a virtual Defend DC environmental mask call. DC and DMV residents, for more info, you can call 443-492-8008. On Thursday, March 20th, the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, invites you to the talk and book signing for Global Battlefields with author and legendary public intellectual from the Global South, Walden Bellow. The first session in the series, Lessons from Resistance to Authoritarianism Around the World, 12:30 to 2 p.m. at IPS, 1301 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest DC. You can find more info and register on ips-dc.org/events. On Friday, March 21st, a book discussion, Dismantling the Master's Clock with Rashida Phillips. She will delve into time, racial justice, and quantum physics, and will take place from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. More info can be found on Sankofa.com. On Saturday, March 22nd, from 6:30 to 9 p.m., there will be Community Iftar, a fundraiser for Gaza. Enjoy food at Balkis Restaurant at 5820 Seminary Road, Unit J in Falls Church, Virginia. More info can be found on their social media at DMVPYM. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. To see more info and all events, go to wpfw.org under the Events tab. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, the Honorable Robert Gordon is a retired bankruptcy judge of the District of Maryland. He sat on the United States Bankruptcy Court for the District of Maryland for 14 years. He's a 1982 University of Maryland Carey Law alumnus, and he's also the vice chairman of the WPFW Local Station Board. Welcome back, Judge Gordon.
Hi, Verna. How you doing? It was good to hear all that optimism from Mr. Green. I'm not sure I share it, but...
Well, I think you're not alone in that, Robert, unfortunately, but we've got to come up with some sort of strategies. Mm-hmm. Also joining us again is Professor Melissa B. Jacoby, a law professor at Harvard and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Some of the injustices she noticed in how bankruptcy laws are applied prompted her to write the book Unjust Debts, How Our Bankruptcy System Makes America More Unequal. Good morning, Professor Jacoby.
Good morning, Verna.
Welcome back to What's at Stake.
Thank you.
So, Professor Jacoby, would you say the system is designed to discriminate against people of color and people of little means?
The bankruptcy system is designed to make the best of a bad situation. That's the idea of it. It's in the Constitution. It's supposed to reduce or eliminate debts for financially distressed families. As we talked the last time we were together, the system on a bipartisan basis has become too complicated and too expensive for everyone. And then on top of that, as discussed in Unjust Debts and a lot of research, Black bankruptcy filers pay more for bankruptcy relief and get less protection. And so unfortunately, that is the state of affairs right now.
And why are they paying more? Because of the attorneys that they have access to?
Well, the story has a couple twists and turns. Some of it has to do with what kind of bankruptcy they're choosing. Some of it has to do with what kinds of debts they carry, what kinds of assets or lack of assets they have that other families are able to protect. So a lot of pieces have to come together for that. But overall, there are two kinds of personal bankruptcy right now in America, and Black families are systematically filing in the more complicated and expensive type and the kind that less likely leads to debt relief.
Which one is that, Chapter 13?
That's called Chapter 13, and there's a lot of jargon in bankruptcy, and that's unfortunate because these are real kitchen table issues. These are issues that affect every family, including at a time like right now where things feel very uncertain. So, but yes, they're called different chapters, and Chapter 13 is the payment plan kind of bankruptcy that you don't get relief right away.
And Chapter 7 is the one where the debts are pretty much wiped out?
For someone who has lived an honest life and is very forthright about what they have, and the vast majority of people who go through bankruptcy have very, very little. And so they do get some debt relief at the end, but they still have to pay for their cars and they still have to pay for their houses. And again, there are categories of debts like fees and fines, local fees and fines, which have particular impact on communities of color, cannot be canceled in bankruptcy at this time.
So, Judge Gordon, you sat on the bench for 14 years. Are you familiar with the type of ill treatment Professor Jacoby is referring to that people of color and people of little means are subjected to? And can you recall a particularly egregious case when that type of injustice occurred?
Well, it didn't happen in my court. So, you know.
So the judge really is the one that determines whether or not it's unjust or unequal.
Well, I think what Professor Jacoby's talking about more is in line with, you know, trends and African Americans being shepherded into Chapter 13, where it might not be best suited for them. Mm-hmm. And I guess one thing I want to add to what she said is that, you know, in Chapter 13, not only does it cost more up front, but you can spend a lot of time in it, depending upon where you file bankruptcy and what the local, you know, practices are, and invest more money in it and still have the case crash, you know, to make it all not necessarily pointless, but make it all a lot more stressful on the family that's in the 13 economically. And, you know, not allow them to gain what they thought they were going to gain by being in a Chapter 13 in the first place.
Hmm. So share maybe a story that you experienced, or a case rather, that you experienced during your time on the bench that sticks out for you.
Well, is it okay if I let the debtor tell the story?
Who is the debtor?
Well, I'm not going to give the person's name, of course.
Oh.
Wouldn't be appropriate, but just based upon a letter that was sent to me.
Oh, I mean, sure.
I guess if the question is, you know, does it work in some instances, I'd say that yes, it does. Folks can get the relief that they hope to get, but it can be a long and tortuous process. Just to give a brief background, this particular debtor had an extended, a very extended, very expensive, very long, very arduous state law domestic case that preceded the bankruptcy filing, where the belief was is that some acts of abuse had been committed in the family. I'll put it that way, the most delicate way. But serious business, like very, very serious business. She had to fight to get the discharge at the end of the day. And that involves a lot of unnecessary complication, most of which would probably fall on the shoulders of this debtor's attorney. So without getting deep into the details, the case went on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I granted her her discharge because essentially she hadn't done anything wrong.
Okay.
She was honest. She lived up to her responsibilities. The system didn't live up to its responsibilities around her and with respect to the case that she had pending. So I granted her her discharge. It was actually the last order that I entered. When I left the court in June 2020. And a few years later, I was surprised and happy to see an email arrive in my inbox at the law school, and this is what it said. "Hi, Judge Gordon. I've been wanting to thank you personally for quite some time. This month marks 7 years since I filed bankruptcy. In the time since you granted my discharge and left the bench, I've thought of you and wanted to reach out and thank you many times. I wasn't sure if it was appropriate. On a human level, though, I wanted you to know the impact you have had on my life and how grateful I am for the discharge you gave me. First, I'd like to thank you for the humanity you showed me on the bench. Of the many court professionals and court systems I had to navigate, circuit court, district court, bankruptcy, CPS, Child Protective Services, that's short for police, you were one of the only people in these systems who showed me humanity and treated me with dignity. I can't even begin to tell you how much that meant to me and still means. Secondly, I want to personally thank you for my discharge. I do not really understand why you chose my case for your last opinion, but from the bench, but I'm grateful that you did. Since then, while my life has not been without pain or hardship, I've managed to rebuild and create a beautiful life for myself and my kids. I've remarried, had another child, and am pursuing meaningful and impactful work. I've had the opportunity to create some wonderful memories with my children. So much of this and the life I have now would never have been possible without the discharge you granted. One of the many hard lessons I learned through all I went through is that some debts can never be repaid, but they can be paid forward. That's what I'm trying to do through my research and practice as a nurse, the way I can repay the support and grace I was given through helping and advocating for others. I'm grateful for your role in the opportunity I have to do that. Thank you again for the difference you made in my life, for the difference you made in my life. I'm eternally grateful.
Let's say, wow. Yeah. Well, congratulations for being the type of person that would be that would inspire someone to motivate someone to write that heartfelt letter. And you know what occurred to me is this was 7 years after her case was. So is that the length of time that it takes for a bankruptcy to actually be removed from your credit record?
Kind of. The years that people talk about in terms of the 6 years or the 7 years, you know, you hear both numbers out there in the general public. That's the period of time that has to expire before you can file bankruptcy again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
I think Professor Jacoby might be more familiar with the requirements as to when something like that needs to be removed from the credit report. But that's a different issue than, you know, the statutory limit on, you know, how often somebody can file bankruptcy after having filed bankruptcy once mm-hmm. or twice, or maybe even more than that.
Right. So, Professor Jacoby, there is a new sheriff in town, so to speak, the Trump administration, that is. Are you at all concerned, based on the changes that we've witnessed so far, that bankruptcy system will be impacted negatively by the actions of DOGE?
I am concerned. Since we last spoke, the Trump administration terminated the director of the person in the Department of Justice who oversees the administration of the bankruptcy system. That is not a political position. It is a civil service position. No reasons were given. By every indication, this was an illegal removal, as we've seen in other contexts. No notice was given. And again, the only grounds that were given were that he's in charge here now, basically. So that likely is going to be challenged. The program that oversees the administration of the bankruptcy system, not the courts, because the courts often they're not trials in every bankruptcy. Many people who go through bankruptcy never even see the judge in their case.
Oh, wow.
When we're talking about issues of race disparities and the like, we're talking about structural forces and other forms of steering, potentially other parties in the system. But when we're looking at the administrative oversight that comes from the Department of Justice, that is, again, it's not a political position. It is typically not tied to who's president at the time. Mm-hmm. And from everything I've heard, that system already is extremely leanly staffed across the country, that very small numbers of people are asked to do a lot of work. And they do, from what I understand, they really do their best.
Mm-hmm.
If we see, as expected, bankruptcy filings going up in the coming years, they're already going up. And given the upheaval now, one might expect down the road, mm-hmm. if people take on more credit card debt and the like to try to fill the gaps, that they may try to seek bankruptcy too. The fear is that without a functioning system there, that these cases will take longer. That's not good for anyone in the system. That's not good for people who are owed money. And it is not good for the families who are trying mm-hmm. to get some resolution to their problems. So the kind of upheaval we're seeing elsewhere that, again, is typically, as I understand it, not legal, not following proper procedures, and also has these other effects on real people, I fear we could see that in the bankruptcy system too, although I'm sure everyone in the system who's still there is going to work as hard as they can to do their jobs under the law.
So, I'm really surprised. Go ahead, Robert, Judge Gordon.
I just wanted to also add to Professor Jacoby's comments, that focusing on the consumers who were involved in bankruptcy, the U.S. trustee system, they step in to these gigantic cases that get filed at the at the very beginning of these cases and offer oversight and points of view that counsel in favor of restraint when the corporations that's filed and their financial backers will want to get everything they can get up front to sort of set the template for how the case is going to unfold, that will have an impact on the community and individuals, consumers, sometimes, often, usually claimants who have some legitimate grievance against the corporation, to spin things in a way that they want it spun up front. And if the U.S. trustee's office is further hamstrung by the kinds of DOGE impact that we've seen in other areas in the federal government, that's going to make it exceedingly difficult for them to do their job in those cases that are just as important when individuals are filing bankruptcy on their own. One quick example, it was the U.S. trustee's office that continued to pursue the appeal all the way up to the Supreme Court in the Purdue Pharma case that, of course, involved, opioid addiction, not just in the United States, but in a worldwide basis, to stop the injustice that was occurring in that case. And that's what they do.
That was a bankruptcy case? That was a bankruptcy case?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it was a huge biggie in our world.
Yes.
Sure. Which kind of, it frustrates me that the rest of the world, the rest of the public, this doesn't get on the media radar that often. Not to go into a long extended thing about it, but in Purdue Pharma, the individuals that own the company, the Sackler family, they were trying to escape personal liability through using the bankruptcy case. And this had become pretty much standard practice over the past 20, 30 years around the country in huge cases. You frequently have corporations filing because they want to evade mass injury situations that drive them into bankruptcy. And bankruptcy judges have been allowing this to happen. Not in every case, but it frequently happens. So the issue finally reached the Supreme Court last summer, and by a 5-4 vote, Supreme Court said, no, that's not something that the bankruptcy code allows, which...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So now we hear about these cases where individuals like a Donald Trump have filed bankruptcy numerous times. And I'm wondering if the average person, Professor Jacoby, can actually file bankruptcy repeatedly. And who is determining, I know you said that they're steered towards Chapter 13, but who actually determines whether it's going to be Chapter 13 or Chapter 7? I know there's two different questions.
Well, let's remember what bankruptcy can and cannot do. Bankruptcy can change how much money someone owes to their creditors. Bankruptcy cannot train someone for a job. It doesn't print money. It's not a form of health insurance, all those things. So it does sometimes happen because people end up in a risky society, ending up having financial trouble more than once, that they might want to seek bankruptcy relief again. Bankruptcy law discourages people from doing that in quick succession because it limits what rights and protections you will have if you try to file bankruptcy again too quickly.
Is there a time frame?
Well, there are different time frames for the protection you get during the bankruptcy versus after the bankruptcy. So where Judge Gordon was talking about the 7 or 8 year period, for getting another discharge, debt cancellation at the end. That's the limit there. But I think we want to think about this a little bit more broadly. We do see families repeatedly filing for bankruptcy. That is not a form, in most cases, that is not a form of trying to get too much from the system. What it means is that their first case didn't work. They were in a they were in a Chapter 13. Their paperwork was filed for Chapter 13. They agreed to be in a Chapter 13. They paid a lot of money, and then they paid every cent of their disposable income to that plan, but they couldn't make it through. They had another job lost. Someone else got sick. Their case got dismissed. So, and they didn't get any debt relief. Now, all those debts come roaring back and everyone's trying to collect them. They're allowed under some circumstances to file again quickly. But again, they're going to pay more money to file. They're going to then put themselves into a very strict repayment plan. So where we see people repeatedly entering the bankruptcy system is when their first repayment plan didn't work and someone says, well, give it another try. So that is not an uncommon phenomenon, at least in certain parts of the country.
So we're running down on time, but Judge Gordon, part of the purpose of filing for bankruptcy is to get a fresh start on a unmanageable financial situation. And filing a Chapter 7, for example, can allow an individual to sort of wipe the slate clean in some instances. And while that could make a person feel relieved and joyful and grateful, like the young lady that you that wrote you the letter, I'm wondering if there are other emotions that come into play, guilt or feelings of being irresponsible, even fear. Judge Gordon.
Yeah, I mean, you get the full range of emotions. I mean, they're not necessary. Understand, I mean, when I was on the court, like with, you know, all judges, we're on the bench. We come out in the courtroom and we hear what's presented to us in court. So you're not necessarily going to get that sort of range of emotions expressed in court. But certainly we've had situations where there are tears, where there's sadness, where there's, you know, more or less an emotional breakdown. I mean, it can happen. In fact, it happened with the debtor whose email I just read. You know, she had to testify and it wasn't pleasant. So you do get all of that. I think the only other area in the law that might be equivalent to this on a consistent basis is probably domestic, you know, for obvious reasons. But when folks are about to lose everything, sure. I mean, there's that tension. And, you know, that was something I had to deal with when I was practicing too.
And finally, in a little bit of time we have left, about a minute left, what resources, Judge Gordon, do you know of locally where people could get more information and advice? And can you remind us of whether there are pro bono or no cost ways to be represented very quickly?
Yeah, definitely. The District of Columbia Bar, I would refer people to their website for help with pro bono or, you know, free legal services. It's extensive and there's a lot of good information on there. I don't know if you want me to give the phone number or not. I can't.
If you have it, yes.
Okay, sure. Phone number 202-737-4700. But if you Google DC Bar Association, that'll come up. Maryland Volunteer Lawyer Service, for the listeners in Maryland, they provide pro bono legal services of all types too, including bankruptcy. Their number is 410-539-6800. And if you go to the website of the United States Bankruptcy Court for the District of Maryland, you'll find the Debtor Assistance Project that you can get a half an hour of free legal advice. That was a project I was involved with on the bench, and I'm glad to see it's still functioning. So
there is help. Thank you. Thank you both so much for this valuable information that you all have shared in this series on Bankruptcy 101. That, of course, was retired Judge Robert Gordon and Professor Melissa B. Jacoby. Thank you both so much for your contribution. And that's pretty much going to do it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thank you all for listening. Next week, Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo will be in the host seat. Thank you to all our guests this morning, Adam Green, Professor Melissa Jacoby, and Judge Robert Ward. Thank you to our engineer extraordinaire, Michael Nasella. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Faye Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In the words of the late, great Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done.
Jazz lovers, the 15th Annual Washington Women in Jazz Festival is back with a weekend of performances, workshops, and jam sessions at the Penn Arts Mansion in Washington, D.C. on March 29th and 30th. From interactive workshops to concerts and late-night jams, there's something for everyone. Details at washingtonwomeninjazz.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, WPFW. Festival season is here, and on April 6, noon until 7:30 p.m., Words, Beats, and Life kicks it off with the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam. Family-friendly activities, art activations, food truck vendors, and performances will all happen in Franklin Park. Details at wblinc.org/WBLFest.
Hello, I'm Dave Zirin, host of WPFW's The Collision, with an editorial. Mahmoud Khalil, a student at Columbia University and a U.S. permanent resident, has been illegally detained by ICE for organizing against the U.S.-supported genocide in Palestine. In detaining Khalil, the Trump administration, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security have made clear that they are more than willing to violate constitutionally protected rights to punish those who speak out against them and Israel's war on the people of Gaza. This is a deeply alarming development. It is a march towards authoritarianism. It is a blatant encroachment on our democracy, and it places all of us in peril, especially members of the most vulnerable and marginalized communities in our country. In the words of Angela Davis, if they come for me in the morning, they will come for you at night. Standing together as people of conscience and demanding Mahmoud Khalil's freedom, it is a stand against fascism, and it is a stand for our collective right to free speech and protest. I'm Dave Zirin. This has been a WPFW editorial.
How do you find peace and happiness amidst all the uncertainty around us? On March 20th, the International Day of Happiness, spiritual leader Gurudev Sri Sri Ravi Shankar will be in conversation with author Arthur Brooks at the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. for Unlocking Happiness. Practical tools to cultivate joy backed by science and timeless wisdom will be shared, including a live guided meditation by Gurudev. Details at aolf.me/UHDC.
Do you love captivating stories about our planet and the people who protect it? The DC Environmental Film Festival returns to theaters throughout the metro area March 20th through the 29th. This year's lineup boasts over 50 programs featuring films from all over the world about issues from environmental justice to wildlife conservation and our oceans. Details at dceff.org. That's dceff.org. Use your heart and not your
eyes. African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora is featured at the 21st New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 14 to the 27th. The festival features 29 films from 19 countries, discussions with filmmakers, and more. The 2025 New African Film Festival features the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa. Tickets and full schedule at AFI.com/silver. That's AFI.com/silver or at 301-495-6700. That's 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to the Collision.